541, public hearing. And welcome to the committee again, Diane. Would you proceed?
Good morning. Chair Crowe, members of the committee, I'm Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And we're here today to begin the detailed presentation on the budget. As I had indicated last week, we're divided into a number of sections. One of those is criminal justice, then we have the fire service section, we have private security, and then we also have the memorial fund. Under the criminal justice section, we have the training and certification that occurs for law enforcement officers, corrections officers, parole and probation officers, and the 911 telecommunicators, emergency medical dispatchers. The services in that particular section are provided both for training and for the certification and records keeping. The primary goals in that particular section at this point in time for law enforcement are to get us from the 10 weeks of training to the 16 weeks of training that was required about 4 years ago, and we're still working on that process. The other primary goal is to increase the way that we can deliver training through both distance learning and through regional delivery, and also to begin a regular process of doing job task analysis, which is what allows us to stay up to date on curricula for each of those particular disciplines. We are also improving our accreditation process, which allows us to have alternative delivery providers, such as the colleges and community colleges, where that's appropriate. And we're doing an aggressive approach at evaluating the safety protocols that we have in place for all of our different types of trainings. While we've not had any major accidents of any kind, thank goodness, we want to make sure that that continues, especially as we begin to increase, and will increase significantly once we get to the new facility, the amount of skills training that does occur. The other part of that is that we are incorporating into the basic police as much as we can the field training portions, so that we have field training officers that are actually being with and watching their recruits throughout the process, so that they're ready to take the handoff at the end of 16 weeks and work with those individuals in the field. As I mentioned last week, most of the country is at about 22 to 24 weeks of training for their law enforcement. We are still trying to pursue 16. Well, obviously when we get to 16, we'll still be behind the national average. But one of the ways we think we can keep ahead of that curve and not have to go to more training is to have those field training officers a part of the training, and then there'll be a smooth transition into the actual work in the field with an experienced instructor that's right with them, and that should take care of some of that additional weeks. The other thing we'll look at eventually is doing the intermediate advanced instead of more basic. Our perspective is, and in working with our constituents, we believe that you get to a certain place where the learning curve stops with the initial learning. Then you need to go out and actually do the work and do the job. Then a person is ready to come and add to those skills. But you can only just do so much in basic. The hope is then that we'll be able to deliver a lot more of that more advanced training on a regional basis, and maybe only occasionally bring officers back for a week or two for something specialized that takes the equipment that's available at the core facility. I mentioned last week that the way we train is through the theme-enhanced scenario-based training. That has been extremely valuable to us. Not only does it give the officer training that's occurring much more in the way they actually operate, so they understand the process when they go to the street, but it also allows us to see the officer not only in terms of what they're learning and what their skill base is, but it helps us understand their attitude and their thinking. And one of the things that has been most appealing to us, and I think to agencies, is we have been able to detect those officers that have kind of a natural over-aggressive tendency, and we've eliminated them during basic training rather than after an incident has occurred with their home agency. The other thing we're able to see in the training, which you couldn't tell before, was people who have biases, and they come out when they're training. And if those biases are so significant that we're not able to train them in such a way that they can overcome them or recognize them so they don't interfere with their work, again, we've asked agencies to withdraw them from the academy at this early stage.
I'm interested in this subject area, and I was looking for an opportunity to ask you about it. But when you read something or hear of something such as the latest thing in the Portland Police Bureau with the CERT team members doing the hazing and possibly engaging in other similar boorish activities, Do you take from that some kind of a lesson to teach new recruits or to talk to new recruits about, or how is that information used?
Territorial Representative Leonard, many of our scenarios are based on real-life situations, and you're exactly right. When things like that occur, we use them. What we have made a conscious effort to not do is take a scenario that's right at hand and in any way be in a situation where we're criticizing the agency that's working through a particular problem. But when something is complete, then we will sit down and look at it from a number of different directions, and then many times we have actually incorporated that into scenarios. Or we will talk to students in generic terms about the impacts of those kinds of incidents on the agency, not really talking about whether they did or didn't happen, but even some of the perceptions of what they do and how the public may perceive what it is they're doing and what their mindset might be and what the impact might be. Ethics is a very, very big part of our curriculum, and it's woven throughout the entire curriculum. So we are constantly talking to them about the decisions they make and how they may be unethical or they may appear to be unethical. And so, yeah, we actually do work those in. The same things with some of the inmate escapes. We will take those after the fact. Or if there's been an officer shooting, we will look at that after the fact and look at it in terms of the strategies that were used, the safety mechanisms that were used or not used, and use those all the way along as a part of our training base.
Mr. Chair, let me pull that up. I mean, because for a lot of us, when we see repeated examples of that kind of thing happening, wonder, and well, I wonder what kind of training they had originally. I know in my own professional background, just the idea of serving the public was just why we were there. I mean, it was beat into us in that any cross word or any kind of behavior that brought embarrassment on the Portland Fire Bureau was cause for immediate termination, and they did it. And I just wonder what the mentality must be just across the street, so that men and women my own age, my same number of years, have just such a complete opposite attitude. Are you saying that maybe at some time back they didn't focus on those kinds of behaviors as much, or maybe even, thinking about the question, maybe even encouraged it? I know was the case until not long ago, but I guess just with my own background, I just don't understand how men and women behave the way they do going through training. And hopefully, are we using the proper criteria to pick police officers, or should there be other criteria that we're not using?
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, there was a lot of questions in there,
but
let me give it my best
shot. Thinking out loud.
A couple of things. One, I still do believe it's the exception rather than the rule, but one of the other things you pointed about is there has been a huge cultural change in law enforcement. Things that in the past were acceptable are clearly not acceptable any longer, and we are very much talking about them out loud and with the classes. And we use real-life situations to work with students, and I'll give you an example of that. We had an incident about, I'm going to say 2 years ago now, where we have, at any college campus, there's always parking issues. And we have one parking lot that's behind our facility, and it was overcrowded. One of the rules is that students who came to the academy had to park in a farther out parking lot, since they were all weak and not moving their vehicles. Some of them decided that was inconvenient and parked in the lot anyway, and so we arranged to have them ticketed, and they took the position they didn't have to pay those tickets because they weren't going to go to school here and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, we sat down and said, hey, wait a minute. You know, if you want to be in law enforcement, how can you take that attitude that, you know, you're above certain laws and you can decide to pick and choose when? For this group, that had not occurred to them. And they sat down and ended up having some very meaningful discussion, and some peer pressure came to play. It happens occasionally that we'll have students do things that are out of line. And one of the things that we really reinforce is that they have an obligation to come forward and end that behavior not supported. In our training scenarios, we have the role players, when they're doing pat downs or whatever, take money from a suspect, stick it in their pocket, and we wait to see if the students tell us or don't tell us about this. And we have serious discussions with the students who don't tell us about it. Some of these things have never really put on the table. We talked about it in a lecture format, but we didn't put them in the situation where they had to make the decisions of how they personally were going to react to that. With the scenario-based training, they now have to react and make their own personal choice. And then we get to see that, and we can report back to agencies where we think these individuals have weaknesses. Now, in terms of selection, I think we're probably doing better than ever before in the selection process, in that we have gotten to the point where we know more about the psychology that makes up a good officer. But we have a lot of generations of officers within the ranks now that were picked under different criteria, have different sorts of mindsets, and some of them are very, very exceptional, but we have all different spectrums. We now have a new challenge, which is what we call the Generation Xers, who look at the world very, very differently. And we sit down and have discussions with them about loyalty and public service, and some of that's a foreign concept. It's just a job, and if it's not fun, they're going to move on to something else. And so we're looking at a whole different group of people now. But that, from my perspective, is one of the real benefits that we have gotten from scenario-based training, is we can now see those attitudes and those tendencies and get them on the table and talk about it. But I hope we're picking good people, and I hope that we stay with it. I would like to see the incidents never happen, but if they are, I hope it, because it is human nature that they will be smaller and smaller as we go through time.
Do we have time for me to ask another question?
Go ahead if you want.
I'm interested. So these Generation X, I was interested in what you said about them seeing it as a job. Have you had an opportunity to track any of them to see how they actually perform?
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, we are just now starting to see them come in and starting to recognize it for what it is, and we haven't really tracked them, but it's something I would certainly like to track. We as in BPSST did a 20-year psychological profile on a number of officers, and it would be interesting, both of those psychologists are still available, interesting to see if they'd be interested now in coming through and maybe tracking some of our Generation Xers to see what the difference is. One of the things we are already seeing is a tendency to stay for shorter periods of time, which is an added challenge to the recruitment process and keeping the ranks filled.
Thank you.
Do most states use a scenario-based training?
Chair Trow, they do not, but they're starting to go in that direction as we're all seeing the benefits from it. So I think it will be the common way to train before long. The challenge with it is that it, of course, takes more space because the students have to be up and active and working in groups and that sort of thing. And it takes more instructors because you have to have more people watching and objectively observing. And then the testing itself becomes more challenging because there's the tendency to be subjective, and so we have to get our instructors to be looking for specific things and not looking just at who they like and don't like, but being able to score objectively, and so that's been a real challenge as well.
Have there been any problems with the evaluation? Have people disputed evaluations?
Chair Trow, just like any test, students will contest the answer when they get it wrong.
Okay, but nothing out of
nothing out of the ordinary.
Diane, is there a place in your handout that they could be following along?
I am more or less at about page 14 now.
Okay.
And what I was about to launch into was the regional training, which is another component of our training. It predominantly kicks in from basic on and covers an officer for the rest of their career, and this is true in all of our disciplines. In regional training, we do a number of specialized courses, everything from your DARE program for your drugs and your school resource officers to your standardized field sobriety tests, any of your defensive tactics, emergency vehicle operations, all of your skills. We also meet our legislative mandate for hate and bias crimes through regional training. It is also, of course, incorporated in the basic. The same thing with child abuse and the multidiscipline protocols, professional traffic stops, domestic violence, domestic terrorism and the field training evaluation programs. All of those, plus all the instructor components that go with those, are all a part of regional training. And there's probably, I don't know, 200 to 300 different kinds of regional training that goes on in any given year throughout the state. One of the things that we are trying to do with the training division and is to have, as a regional component, a regional office that would have a criminal justice regional trainer, as well as a fire service regional trainer, and then a support person that would help with all the certification records that occur in the scheduling process. And that's what you will see as we get into the policy option packages, as it starts to fill that need. It is very expensive for local agencies to continue to send people back, and it's too expensive to come back for an hour-long class or a 2 or 4 hour-long class. So what we try to do is get the equipment, get the people, get the instructors, and send those out throughout the regions and kind of make a circuit throughout the state to make sure the training occurs.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Nan, on the DARE officer training, 80 hours annually, is that to each individual officer, or who gets that 80 hours of training?
Chair Crow, Representative Doyle, it's those officers who have been selected by their agencies to become a DARE officer. So it's only select officers that get that particular program. Each of these are done more as an in-service. The agencies pick what it is they want, so all of these are not mandated every year that they get them. We from time to time have courses that are mandated. We actually have tried each session to discourage that from regional, because it's very difficult, number one, to get everyone trained in a particular topic every year, but then people are doing such diverse things in their field that so long as they are continuing to get training that's relevant to the work they're doing, plus some of their basics that they need, proficiencies they need to keep up, that seems to work real well. But for DARE, it is selected individuals who are designed to.
And then are you on the DARE, I guess, course itself? I mean, the press articles over the last couple of years have questioned how effective that particular program is. Are you folks seeing the same concerns, or?
Chair Representative Doyle, we are, and we're seeing a little less interest in it, but what it is shifting to is a school resource officer, and many of those same skills adapt real well to that. And so that's what we're finding, is more schools are asking for that, and how do we keep the officers in the schools and communicating with the kids to avoid school place violence.
Thank you.
Diane, how does the regional training unit relate to the basic core training? We're talking about 16 hours. You get 16 hours in the basic, and then you get more in the regional? Are these the same people that are being trained? How does that work?
Chair Tro, the basic is 16 weeks long, and the regional training is officers who have graduated from basic, and this is the education that goes with them throughout their career. So they get varying courses throughout their entire history as an officer. Many of the same instructors are used, but we also have a pool of regional instructors to assist in the regional area so that we aren't always transporting instructors. But a lot of times in the more rural or remote areas, we will have to bring instructors right along with the equipment to do the training. So there's a very close connection, and that's part of the reason that in the agency we blended the training division. And in fact, Division Director Eric Gablitz is sitting right here. If you had any questions for him, he is the person who's now responsible for coordinating both the basic training and the regional training. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, yeah, obviously some people go on and get substantially more training, and it's generally officers, people who are sort of online and are going to be the leaders in the profession. Is that it? Or?
Chair Trow, that's correct to some extent, but all officers need to continue training throughout their career. Many of the skills they learn have, they deteriorate over time if they aren't learning and constantly working with them. And so what we do and what their agencies do is try to provide continued training to them. We also have supervision and middle management courses and executive level for those who begin to work their way up through a management level course. These are designed for all officers, whether they're management level or not, but it keeps their skills honed and introduces new topics as well, anytime there's law changes and that sort of thing. Our standards and certification section that is connected with training, as I indicated, works on the job task analysis. We try to do those on a rotation basis for each of the disciplines. They should be done at least once in every 5 years. And part of the reason that we have to do that is our standards need to continue to be defensible and also verifiable within the courts. It's absolutely imperative when an officer goes to court that they can explain the training that they've had, verify their training record, which is the other thing that standard and certification does, and then be able to be sure that they have had the most current training in whatever that particular area might be, and then that they performed according to what the recognized protocols are, whether it's in defensive tactics or firearms or those kinds of things. We also do what's called a LEMAP, which is a Law Enforcement Management Assistance Program. And from time to time, agencies will ask us to help them with a particular issue that they might be having. We have helped set up evidence lockers. We have worked with new managers in setting up their policies and protocols and those kinds of things. We're also currently, we have an accreditation committee that is wrestling with some issues that we basically haven't looked at in about 20 years, and we're looking at, okay, now how do we do this now in this day and age? And they're going back through and revamping all of our laws and all of our administrative rules as they relate to the working relationship we have with other entities that bring in training and how we accredit those and make sure that they're still verifiable in the courts and defensible. We also, one of the small tasks that we do is we review the sheriff's candidates for eligibility for office, and that only happens every couple of years when we have a new round of sheriffs running for office. And then the main thing that we probably do, which is most important to our constituents, I think, is to keep all of their training records. When we did our strategic planning 3 years ago now, we had a number of meetings throughout the state, and that came through as one of the things they would really like is for once and all for all to have a centralized tracking system for records. Officers do move from agency to agency, and what they were finding is in doing that they were losing their training records if they weren't in a central location. The other thing we're also seeing now is officers moving between the different disciplines. So we have officers that are certified as both law enforcement and corrections, and some of them also have parole and probation, and some of them may be linked with 911. And now we're also having them cross between fire service and police. And so we're trying to get our information system to the point where it will allow all those trackings in a person's career by having a singular number that follows a person rather than multiple numbers. And so that's beginning to work. The things that are impacting us the most.
Diane, could you tell me about the review of sheriff's candidates to determine eligibility to run? Must they have a certain level of training? Is that, and if you say that they're not eligible, may they run anyway? What happens in that process?
Chair Trow, the way it works is they probably would, I guess they could probably run. They won't appear in the voter's pamphlet, and they won't be recognized as an applicant because the clerk's office actually waits for a certificate from us that indicates that we have verified that they're eligible to run. And as far as training goes,
what does it take for them to be eligible? What do you look for?
I'm going to have to check back to make sure I give you this exactly right. But one of the things they have to do is there has to be a period of law enforcement experience, and they have to be able to be certified within a year. So that means they have to either redo their basic or be able to do a career officer development course within a year of taking office. So they have a little bit of a buffer. And I believe there's some age requirements and residency requirements and those kinds of things. But generically, that's it.
So it's just a matter of deciding whether or not they may run, and you decide nothing else about them.
Preference
given or anything.
Other than to indicate that they would be able to be trained as an officer and be certified is what we let the courts know. The major factors impacting us right now, probably the biggest one is the inadequate facilities. As I indicated a little bit before, we're at the point now where we are frozen at 10 weeks just because that's the maximum the building could possibly hold, and every building we could find to rent and every space we could find to use anywhere around we are using and just cannot get any farther. We are currently, for law enforcement, doing traffic stops. actually one of them in a wildlife refuge and the other in a city park, which is not real great for when the community comes to use the city park and we have officers there with patrol vehicles and lights on and weapons pulled and those kinds of things. And even though we're using simulation weapons, they look very real, and that's just not a good thing to have occurring in a park setting, and we've had some fairly interesting experiences. We have it marked everywhere that it's training in progress, but people drive right past the signs and then get scared, which is not a good thing to be doing. The other thing is our emergency vehicle operation course has been for a long time and continues to be an abandoned airstrip at Corvallis Airport. And while this has served us well, it's not even close to adequate. We cannot do any training at night because of the lights at the airport and any confusion that might cause. We cannot actually drive over about 45 to 50 miles an hour, so the officers kid about driving faster at 55 to get to their training strip than they actually can drive on their strip. And part of the reason for that is the surface that it is and the condition that the surface is in. It's just unsafe to go any faster than that. They're not able to do any training where they have city streets or obstacles. There's no variation. There's no hills. There's no variation in pavement. All it is just a piece of straight asphalt, and that really has proved to be very inadequate for doing emergency vehicle operations. Our range is out at Camp Adair, which was a range built, I believe, in 1941. We've done a few modifications to it, but not much. It's a fixed target range, so it's for marksmanship more than anything. So the officers don't have the opportunity to learn the use of barricades effectively. They are not able to do any nighttime firing. Most incidents that lead to firing, unfortunately, happen after dark or in subdued lighting, and they don't have any ability to practice that at all. And there's no way to do anything where there's any mobility or action around it, such as actually driving your vehicle and getting out and grabbing the right set of weapons and all those kinds of things. They never get to practice any of that. So all of those are things that we're working on with the facilities. We have one gym, and as I mentioned last week, we're often training as many as five classes going at any given time. Both corrections and police need a lot of room or use of mat rooms and gymnasiums and those kind of things. And so we have been transporting to the Dallas Armory. Right now we're using the abandoned library at the school until they start remodeling that. So every little piece we can find, we use. And that still only gets us to 10 weeks. So that is our largest hurdle. Recruiting difficulties, that has really been a challenge for us. As you can imagine, most of our instructors, most of our staff has to have some kind of a public safety background to understand what we're doing. That gives us a very limited pool of people to draw from. Our instructors, as I indicated, are predominantly full-time employees with agencies, so we use those as much as we can. As we get to 16 weeks, we're going to have some full-time instructors to augment that group because there just are not enough officers available and people to keep us staffed to be able to ramp up to a full 16 weeks. Our location has been a challenge for us. Monmouth does not seem very far away, but for some people, it's very far away, and they have been unwilling to commute or work that far. That will create challenges as we begin the new siting as well. And obviously, we're very, very conscious of backgrounds, and so we have had individuals who have applied that did not meet our standards for backgrounds in terms of criminal histories and those kinds of things, and we just won't allow them to work at the training academy with the numbers of things that they have access to there. In terms of where we're going for enhancements in this next biennia, in terms of administration, there's only one position, and that's to take our human resource person. And I think I'm at about page 23 now, more or less. 27, is that where I am? Oh, yeah. Yep, 27. We have been doing a lot of hiring and a lot of growth, and we have been using this, our personnel officer, at a full-time basis. She was at a 0.37, I believe. Is that right? Okay. and we'll be taking her all the way to full-time for this. That's all that's in that particular package. And our package 111 has to do with our regional training, and that, as I indicated earlier, we're looking to have people in each of our training regions. This will give us three of those individuals, and it will be a person that will be located in Eastern Oregon, a person in Central Oregon, and a person in Southern Oregon, to begin the process of the teams of the criminal justice, fire service, and the clerical. It also has one traffic safety person, and that person is currently with us. They're working on an ODOT grant for traffic safety, and it continues. That person is a full-time employee. Package 112, we call that our 16-week transition package, and what that does is gives us, in the second half of the biennium, one full-time instructor, and what we will use that person for is to do the groundwork for bringing in some full-time instructors. They will take a look at what it's going to take to work the full-times with the part-times, where we're going to have the greatest needs, develop a training curriculum for a full-time instructor, and blend those people into the scenario-based curriculum. In package 114, that's our standard and certification one, focusing on predominantly distance learning, but the people that are in that are technical people that will help us create the videos that we use for distance learning that are in those programs, but they're also going to create the videos for our 16-week curriculum and our corrections curriculum. And that way, as Chair Trow indicated, it's sometimes challenging to standardize, and we will be able to do that by having the scenarios in a video format, and that way you don't always have to bring in role players. You'll be able to repeat the same scenario many times over, stop it, change its ending, change the players and pieces by having someone who can create these videos for us. It will also work in our testing, because what we're trying to do is get to a point where the final, probably week, will be performance-based testing, where we'll put people through through the whole process and make sure they, in fact, can answer calls and do everything that's required of an officer. What it will do then is give us a test bank, because any test that you repeat over and over again, it's not very long before the answers are shared and well known. And so these people will continually present those videos, but will have them so that they are studied and verified against the testing process. So that's primarily what that group of individuals will be for, is to make that whole thing happen. Package 115 is tied to House Bill 2098, which is the funding for the 911 training, and that adds that funding back in to our budget, assuming that the sunset clause is lifted.
Is that bill going through the process?
It is. I believe it's in e-commerce.
That's correct.
E-government at this point.
Has it been considered at all?
It has been considered. I don't think the training piece is what's causing the problem. I think the other part is the PSAPs that are around the state trying to come to some decision. And I'm sensing that we're probably going to have a work group on those, is what we're hearing potentially. But I think the sunset will eventually be lifted before the session's over. But we're watching that one fairly closely.
It's fairly crucial. Yeah. Is that going to come here?
Chair Trow, committee members, the bill is in Ways and Means. It's in the Advancing E-Government Committee right now. It may not need to come to any other subcommittee. It can be reported out of that committee to full committee.
I see.
And there are discussions about lifting the sunset, or at least moving the sunset out, as well as refining how those funds are used.
The budget that we will eventually approve, just assume that's going to happen.
Chair Trow, committee members, what I'd be recommending to you is that we approve this limitation and then request that DAS unschedule it pending the outcome of the decision surrounding that bill. But most of the discussions, as Diane has reflected, do not put in jeopardy this funding for this training. It's mainly centered around how the funds are used to support 58 public safety answering points.
Do you want to cover 117? 117 is just the adjustment we're making for the criminal fines and assessment revenues. And so, again, we have to wait and see how those particular bills come through, but that allows for that, and it also eliminates the transfer that we have done most years to state police, and that's just actually in their budget now. And 550 allows for the debt service, and my understanding is it's to remain unscheduled and until needed for our facilities planning and siting. Oh, and as Bill pointed out to me, reminded me, it has been reduced to 4.6 million rather than 5.4 for debt service. And those were the adjustments that he spoke about as they were working with the criminal fines and assessments, and I think the CAMI fund.
It's the belief that 4.6 million will do what's necessary to service the debt.
Chair Turow, I sure hope so, but it's so early to tell, and I don't know, you know, what they'll actually go for and that sort of thing, but it will certainly get us well on our way, if not there.
Why was 5.4 determined to be the right amount?
Mr. Chair, I hate to say a thumb in the wind, but with the uncertainty of the size of the program, we felt that we would have the ability, really, through scheduling when the time of the COP sale was, that we would be able to at least cover the first year pretty much of whatever you approve. But there's likely there'll be some roll-up in the next biennium when we actually see what the full debt service is.
4.6 is
still a thumb in the wind, but
a problem. We're
convinced we can find a way that we will make it work, and it will not restrict what your decision is in the actual facility.
Now I'm going to shift, if we're ready to fire training.
Fire training.
And that's it. Begins at page 29.
Say 59.
29. Fire training, we approach in a slightly different manner. Fire training is funded by the fire insurance premium tax. And we have about 10,000 firefighters in the state of Oregon, of which between 70 and 80% are volunteers, which is why our approach is a little bit different. Most of our training is delivered regionally to accommodate those volunteer firefighters. And we have set a number of goals for us in the coming biennium. One is to get more training materials to the training associations. There are, I believe, 22 training associations, and we work those in conjunction with some DLOs, which are
district liaison officers.
District liaison officers, Drew Ryan. And there are a number of volunteers, and they rank anywhere from the chief to a firefighter that's willing to help us get the training set up in those areas. They help the agencies with their certification records, and they really work as a conduit for us, which is why we knew that if we were to set up training sites throughout the state, and we're hoping to eventually have 11 of those with the criminal justice, the firefighter, and the support person, that this will make a strong network for training. We're going to do increase, if we can, the amount of assistance we do in delivery, and we'll be implementing more mobile training units for fire service. What we're also doing is completing a transition to the national fire certification standards, also these national instructor standards. What this has done is it's made it so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The national standards for fire service are quite good. There's only been a few things that were not appropriate for Oregon. It made no sense for the firefighters to have to meet two separate sets of standards. And especially because there are so many volunteers, you do see a lot of people training in both directions or making use of training in neighboring states and those sorts of things. And this made our certification process much easier. It made their skills more transportable, and it made it easier for us to import skills when people moved here from other states as well. We will be revising and updating the Fire Ground Leader certification, and we will be continuing to review and adopt the National Rescue Technician certification. That's been a very industrious process. In the last approximately 4 years, we have adopted the bulk of national standards and have those well on their way. Where it was necessary, we developed bridge courses so that only the pieces that were missing did they have to learn and get up to speed in order to have their certification standards. Eric, was there anything you wanted to add to that?
Are we doing a full 16 days for the fire training?
Fire training is very, very different. They don't have a number of weeks of training. Instead, what they have is a sequence of levels of certifications that they get over time. And so as volunteers, they can work on that bit by bit until they gain each level of certification. So they don't ever come and do an entire basic anywhere.
I notice it says here there's a 9 2-day classes.
That's the part of the National Fire Academy class, and we work as the liaison for them in Oregon, and we help sponsor 9 of those 2-day classes around the state. We also have done a couple of week-long classes in conjunction with Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon universities for some things. But they don't get the same bulk of training that law enforcement and the criminal justice providers do. In terms of the connections with standard and certification, it's very much the same as the system we use for law enforcement. And as the officers work through their different certification levels, we process the papers and verify that. And it's the same thing, having defensible and verifiable standards to do that. The primary factors that are affecting our services right now are the lack of resources to meet the amount of demand that we have for training. We do need additional field training coordinators, and we do need more mobile training equipment, but the issue that we have has to do with the revenue from the fire insurance premium tax. And because we do have a retaliatory tax here in Oregon, it makes it very, very difficult for us to increase that level without directly impacting the general fund. One of our projects during this next biennium will be to look at some alternatives to that, because we have absolutely reached the top of what we can do, and we cannot go on to meet the significant demands that are there for fire service training. Fire training is part of our facilities package, however, because there are a number of skills areas that are impossible or difficult to repeat and build throughout the state. So we felt it was important, as did the fire service professionals that were on our steering committee and core group, they felt it was necessary that there is at least one place in the state where this training could occur. And so that has been a part of our facilities planning process and will continue to be. But that won't replace the need to deliver most of that training regionally.
It seems to me that I heard that there's a community college that does a lot of training with fire professionals. Is that right? One of the community colleges?
Chair Tro, I know Chemeketa Community College does, and this.
Same place we are right now, 2 years.
This is Eric Gablitz.
Chair Tro, for the record, Eric Gablitz, Training Director, DPSST. There are a number of community colleges that have fairly sophisticated fire service training programs. Chemeketa, Portland Community College, Southwest Oregon Community College would be ones where they actually provide a lot of hands-on training. And then there are a number of other community colleges that provide the training, but at a different level. Not that it's a worse level, but they don't have the same access to the resources that some of those have. And those community colleges would include Umpqua, Rogue, Central Oregon Community College. They have fire science programs, but they're primarily lecture-based, and they do some skills, but they don't have the level of resources. For example, Portland, Chemeketa have internship programs where those students actually spend time at fire departments to get hands-on skills in addition to their education, where those other programs really aren't at that same level.
Will the new facility then, as it includes firefighters in the facility, change the community college contribution?
I don't believe so. What we see really is a population of approximately 10,000 firefighters. Most of the career departments, the Portlands, Tualatin Valleys, the Eugenes, have fixed facilities because they're at a size where they really can't afford to take a vehicle out of the city and go somewhere for training. They do that in-house. The same with the community colleges. Those are career ladders for those students who are seeking employment in the field, either in Oregon or other states, as it may happen. But then also there's a number of areas where they don't have access to any fixed facilities. So this could pick up that gap and provide places where students can come in for the weekend and get some of those skills training and then send them back home.
See.
I guess if you want.
Okay.
Let's see, in terms of the gaps, as I indicated, that one of the things we're trying to do is get more training regionally. Right now, less than about 40% of those volunteer firefighters are actually certified at the firefighter one level. We need to get a lot more out there. As we looked at the gaps in our service, we developed an assessment, and what we would like to do over several biennia is increase to 22 full-time employees, and what they would do is you would have five of those being the regional fire training coordinators that match up with the criminal justice ones, and then also we would have five training coordinators, but they would be full-time, but they would actually be the payer, the salary base for a multitude of the part-timers, much the way we do in law enforcement training now. It would allow us to have a cadre of part-time instructors to go along with those full-time training coordinators. The other seven would be in standards and cert, and they'd be clerical support as well, and also in the field for that support individual. And five of those would be supporting curriculum and also equipment and construction and maintenance. Like many of our disciplines, part of the training requires destruction of the equipment, and so you're forever rebuilding your props and those kinds of things, and this would allow to have someone do that. As I indicated, we're not asking for that this biennium because we do not have a revenue source to support it, but that is our goal in the biennium, is to identify that revenue source and begin that multi-biennia process.
What are the possibilities for that revenue source?
Chair Troa, you know, I just don't know. We will speak with the insurance industry more to see what their acceptance is in either modifying the fire insurance premium tax or looking for another identifiable source where there's a benefit to them by the increased training, or we will have to look at a totally different source, and we'll just really have to explore what those possibilities might be. I don't have a quick answer for that one yet.
There is a perception, Diane, in the insurance industry, and it was in the hearings we had on the state police budget, the questions I had about fire insurance premium tax, I felt were satisfactorily answered, but the insurance industry has a perception that those dollars aren't being spent wisely. Are you aware of that perception?
Chair Tro, Representative Leonard, I am aware of that, but I've not heard that as it related to training, because we have gotten a huge volume of training out. I know there were some concerns a few years back, but it was my understanding that they were fairly satisfied with the amount of training that we were getting out now, or that we were at least maxed to the amount of people that we have to do it, not that there's enough of it, but that there is more out there, but maybe...
Well, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I wasn't talking specifically about training. It's just that the dollars available are not being used appropriately is the perception. And I don't know that anybody's said anything beyond, well, look at DPSST for an example, just as an example. And we did in the state police budget, and I asked questions and felt like the questions I had were answered to my satisfaction anyway. But there is this perception that persists even after that, that just... And maybe not even just how DPSST spends the dollars, but maybe how the Oregon State Police spends the dollars. Again, for my purposes, I asked questions specifically about where those dollars went, and I felt like they were answered satisfactorily. But it just doesn't seem like, I guess I'm responding to your comment that you're going to talk with the insurance industry, and I'm just wondering how cooperative they're going to be as long as this perception exists that the money that we're getting isn't being spent appropriately now. Maybe if there's some education needs to occur or something.
Chair Tro, Representative Leonard, I think that's the very reason that a work group has to come together during the budget is to make sure that if there are those perceptions, number one, we find out if there's any truth to the perceptions and look at that very closely. If there's not truth to the perceptions, then we need to dispel them and get folks on the right track as to what really is happening. I know that perceptions sometimes can long outlive after a change has been made, so we want to make real sure that people have the most current information and then bring all the players to the table so we can make a real viable decision as to, you know, where there's potential revenue sources. And if that is shifting, then we need to make the conscious effort to shift. If it's finding more, then we need to do that as well. If we need to make reductions, then we need to find out where those ought to be realistically for the good of the state in a broad spectrum.
Well, I think that's a really good idea. You know, we didn't spend a lot of time on the subject, but in the general questions I had and the answers I got back, I felt satisfied. But certainly, if you're aware of that and going into the work group, and I think that would help a lot in maybe opening up their minds to finding more creative solutions for some of these funding issues. But it would just be a concern to me that their specific issues aren't addressed, and it sounds like you're already thinking like that.
Thank you. Did you want to add anything? With that, if there was nothing else in the fire portion, I will switch to private security.
Could you talk about your policy package by chance? Oh. Or at least the... At 090, I believe it's in 090, but it's a...
That's package 090, which is the FEMA training grant, and this package was added to the governor's recommended budget to adjust the federal funds grant received for FEMA. And let's see, this did not take any state matching funds, is my recollection, and let's see, the expenditure limitation is increased by $50,000. Does that take us up to
210 total.
210 total? Yeah. It's the federal FEMA.
Mr. Chair.
Which is domestic, it's our domestic terrorism as well, yeah.
Go ahead, Lynn.
That was what I was going to ask.
What is it for?
Yeah, what is it for?
It's the domestic terrorism grant, and that has actually been a fairly useful grant. I might have, you're back. I might have Eric speak to that as well, but we have been able to do a number of diverse trainings in multiple disciplines in this one as well, so it's been a very useful grant. Do you want to cover what you've done with that one?
Chair Tro, Representative Leonard, what this FEMA dollar allows us to do is that there's actually two funding sources, if you will, coming from FEMA. This one, we received $25,000 currently from the Federal Emergency Management Agency through the National Fire Academy to deliver National Fire Academy programs in the state, whether they're week-long or two-day programs. However that's broken up, we're working with the fire training associations to identify what classes they'd like us to bring here, so it gives us money to provide that. What we've also received, and this will be our third federal grant cycle, we've received $80,000 in this current year for anti-terrorism training, once again from FEMA. And that training is not earmarked specifically to any one course. What it allows us to do is bring an anti-terrorism training to the state, not only weapons of mass destruction, but also we've been able to utilize that for tactical paramedic training, school violence prevention programs, and all those type of things that, you know, when we see domestic terrorism, people think of the larger events with the bombings and those type of things, and we've addressed training with that. For example, last year what we did is we developed a videotape with the Oregon State Police Bomb Squad that we sent out to all the agencies in the state that respond to incidents, basically an awareness of explosive devices. So that was able to put one of those in every public safety agency. But the funds currently were able to do not only basic training, but also training for command-type personnel, as well as those first responders on a variety of terrorism-related type incidents. And this year, we were able to include school violence, because that seems to be, unfortunately, a current trend in the country right now.
Mr. Chair, can you say public safety agencies, you're referring to fire and police?
Yes. Chair Tro, Representative Leonard, public safety includes not only law enforcement, but fire. They are FEMA dollars, but what we have seen the benefit of is to making those classes public safety wide target audiences, because when a true incident happens, it's not just going to be a fire problem, an EMS problem, or a law enforcement problem. All those agencies together are going to respond. So we see the benefit when we do those training opportunities in the state to let all those constituents come, because that way in the training environment, they're able to hear information, but at the same time come up with plans on how they would respond to those incidents if they happened here, because all of those agencies have been involved. And we also have included in some of those classes public works and public health, because it also ends up in the hospital emergency rooms and also within the infrastructures of government. So we try to maximize those training opportunities as possible for everybody that could benefit, but at the same time to keep people that shouldn't be in those classes out. So they need to have a purpose to be there. But within reason, if they're in a government entity, schools is another example, we allow those people to come because they have a benefit. But they have to have a reason to come.
And just before we leave the fire service area, I guess I just wanted to add that I do have a proposed budget note for use in both state police's budget and this one that deals with the formation of the work group to explore alternative ways to come up with more revenue, because they both of them are running up against revenue shortfalls.
We'll look forward to that later. Fire away.
The next topic area is private security, and this is a very unique area for us. It begins on page 36. This is our public-private partnership, and the private security industry came to DPSST back in 95 asking if we would assist them in essence, being regulated and adding professionalism to their industry and allowing them to improve their image. But also what they saw was that as budgets were getting tighter and tighter at the local level, things that had traditionally been done by your law enforcement agencies were now being done by a hired private security agency, and law enforcement were having to do other things. And so there was this definite connection that was being built, and they wanted to foster a good connection between law enforcement and private security. So the partnership was developed, and legislatively it was approved in 1995 session. It is a fee-based, completely operation. It receives no other funds and no general funds. It functions only on the fees received from licensings and renewals. Its primary factors right now that it's dealing with, maybe before I say that, when it began in 95, the expectation was that there would probably be between 4,000 and 6,000 private security individuals that would be licensed. We are now at 18,000. But the fee structure has worked well. As the industry grew, the fees kind of came with it and continued to support itself. But what it has done, as you can imagine, is created a significant workload issue. So we had gotten to the point of having predominantly the staff was temporary employees, and this was very difficult to work with. As temporary employees, they would obviously come and go, and you were constantly in a training mode. So in this particular section, we have a package 130. And what it will do is put to full time those people that had been, not the actual individuals, but those positions that were temporaries will now be full-time positions. It's clear now over the years that that is the number of employees it takes to support this particular section. And so it now does have two full-time OS1s, office specialist ones, and it reclasses one of the existing office specialist ones to a 2. And that's the only changes it makes, and those are kind of an existing work structure right now. The primary factors that affect this particular program are the usual and obvious operational differences between a public and a private entity, but we have what's called a private security advisory committee, and that has worked extremely well in terms of helping folks understand the differences in the functions, the fact that we do have a biennial budget, the fact that you can't just instantaneously hire new people just because the workload's there, those kinds of things. But they've worked well with those challenges. The industry itself has seasonal workload fluctuations, which makes it challenging because there'll be a period of time where it'll kind of be running along, and then the next thing you know, an event hits or the summer hits, and you have massive amounts of private security people to get online. Those are probably the primary, I think, obstacles that we have, but I think we have overcome those very well, actually to the point where when the industry first began, crowd control did not want to be a part of the regulation and was not. And through discussions now, they are kind of phasing in through their supervisors as well and will be coming on board this legislative session. And jointly, the industry has come forward with a bill that allows that modification to happen. At this point in time, the fees are adequate. As we look at the numbers and project for the next biennium, it may be necessary for a slight fee increase, but for right now, it's doing just fine where it is.
Package 130 be paid for by fee increase?
It does. It is. Okay. Yep, it is covered. In fact, it's in essence occurring right now through temp employees and that sort of thing.
Without a fee increase.
If I could clarify.
Yeah, did you say without a fee increase? Yeah.
It's being funded within the existing fee structure,
right,
without a fee increase.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, there's money enough there to do it.
There is money enough there.
Mr. Chair, is the entire program self-supported by the fees?
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, absolutely, it receives nothing. And in fact, it will also be out of its current fees paying for part of the administrative costs, since the agency overall takes care of its computer systems, its human resources, all those kinds of things. It will be completely, absolutely covered by only its fees.
And so if we see a security guard anywhere in the state, we can assume they've been DPSST certified?
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, you can assume they're supposed to be, and they should carry a card that says they are in fact certified if they are doing private security work. Crowd control people, like at events that say, you know, liquor control or, you know, those kinds of things, they may not be, but your actual security officers are supposed to be.
And Mr. Chair, what are the sanctions if they're not?
See if I remember this. Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, there are civil penalties, and I believe it's up to $5,000 per incident, if I recall. And we have some noncompliance, but it's not been bad, although we are just now to the point where the section can actually get into looking at compliance. Right up till now, they were so busy doing all the criminal background checks and getting people certified that they've not actually been able to do a lot of enforcement, but that is beginning. We've had a couple of complaints, and so far people have been very, very good about coming into compliance once they understand.
So, Mr. Chair, so for instance, in Portland, the Association for Portland Progress has those officers downtown that are not Portland police officers, but they work for that association.
Chair,
they carry weapons.
Yeah, Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, I'm not exactly sure about them, but some of those I know were special deputies of the sheriff, and I'm not sure exactly where that particular group falls. But there are armed private security, so it is possible that they are part of this regulated group.
These aren't, I mean, they wear Association for Portland Progress patches. And
let me find out for you.
There was
for
a
sure.
shooting here sometime back, a few years back, involved, and as I understand, they're mostly retired police officers. But I see some when I'm downtown. I see some young men and women that obviously aren't retired. So I'm just curious where they fall in.
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, they're either going to be certified by private security or they'll fit one of the several exemptions that are in the statute. And I'm just not sure without actually checking that particular entity, but I'd be glad to do that for you. Okay, the next section is the Memorial Fund. This was a dedicated fund that is funded through the criminal fines and assessment account that was created last session by legislation. It has its own board, and the board are selected from designated constituents within the board on public safety standards and training. This past biennium, they spent creating the administrative rules and going through. The bill itself was retroactive, so they had to go back to January 97, I believe, and look at the public safety officers that were killed in the line of duty or permanently or totally disabled in the line of duty. The fund itself provides for an initial death benefit. It provides for health and dental insurance. It covers mortgage payments for a year if there's not another insurance policy doing that. And it provides funding for undergraduate scholarships. Obviously, the primary factors affecting this particular fund is the number of applicants that may occur at any time and the availability of the funds. As I indicated, the funding source is the criminal fines and assessment account. We had a cap of $600,000, but I believe the fund was actually, expenditure limitation was $500,000. Yeah, okay. And it has $55,000 that are allowed for administrative costs. What we do know is that that amount of funding will not support what the need is. We're beginning to have some individuals assist the board with some actuarials. The board, as I indicated, is very new. They're very excited about their work, and I know during this next biennium they're going to be looking for alternative funds, donations, those kinds of things to make the fund so it can do what it was actually designed to do. Otherwise, in any given year, especially when we reach the point where scholarships become possible, it's going to be very, very difficult to supply those scholarships. So they will be looking at a way to fund that in a more meaningful way over time. In the first biennium, the benefits that now have been given out, as the report indicates, it's in excess of $215,000, but I believe the last, they're still continuing to give them out, and I think we're just about at $300,000 now. So as you can tell, depending on the year and depending on the number of individuals, and I think we have at least one family with growing children that I believe is 9 children, so assuming they go to college, there could be some significant benefits. And the health and dental goes with them to 18 or 23, depending on whether
the program retroactive and goes back and picks up anybody who happens to be in that category.
Chair Trow, it was retroactive to, I believe, January 97. And this does cover all of the public safety disciplines. So it is police, fire, corrections, P&P, and it covers the reserves and volunteers in both of those if they're killed in the line of duty.
Chair.
Go ahead.
As I recall, there was some discussion about assistant DAs at the time the legislation passed. It didn't.
Chair Trow, Representative, they're not included.
Not there.
Okay. The next area is major construction. And I thought what I would like to do here maybe is give you a little bit of a briefing as to what we have done with the facilities work. We began probably real aggressively, I'm going to say a year ago, more than that probably. And what we did is we pulled together a facilities core group, and we purposely, with the assistance of the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, Fire Service, and a number of other entities, identified individuals that live in this general area, because the core group was going to be tasked with meeting almost weekly to make some of the decisions on the needs assessment, to look at how many classrooms does it take, how many students will be coming in, what the projections are for other agencies, how does training impact the room designs, all those kinds of things. Excuse me. And so they were going to work very closely with the architects and engineers to actually develop that needs assessment. In order to make sure that we had a real good oversight from the whole state, we also had a facility steering committee. And that committee was made up of a larger group of individuals from each of the disciplines. And they came from large and small agencies. They came from all geographic parts of the state to make sure that we were being as inclusive as possible. They met approximately once a month and reviewed the work that the core facility group was accomplishing. We also had our advisory committees from each of our disciplines very active in this process, and also our board, which meets quarterly, also overseeing everything that occurred. Sitting next to me now is Bob Carew, and he is the person that we brought on board during this major construction phase to be our project facilitator. And with your permission, I will turn it over to him at this point, and he can talk about the plan that he has worked on, developed, and where we are.
Senator Trow, Chair Trow, and members of the committee, I'm Bob Carew for the record. I'm Facilities Project Coordinator for DPSST. As Diane indicated, I was brought on to formally kick off this project in approximately February of last year. Over that process, our process was effectively to initiate a project plan that took into account looking at the needs of the facility in the areas of cost, access, and quality to be able to maintain our existing programs. To begin that process, we contracted with a architectural firm, Arbuckle Caustic Incorporated, to do a facility needs assessment. To develop what type of footprint we needed as an academy, both in a minimally adequate facility that would be able to address our current needs, the 16 weeks mandate, and be able to take a look at all our disciplines in that regard. The committee firm took a look at that process and established that we needed a site that would be a minimum of 165 acres to incorporate all of our skills, needs, as well as the type of buildings that we would need to have in place. They set in their diagram, approximately 25 acres of that, 165, four buildings, and the balance of that would be in the form of an emergency vehicle operations track, firing range, and outside skill facilities for fire and other disciplines. Upon completion of that assessment, and in fact, actually, in addition, about the same time, we released a request statewide for communities to indicate their willingness to have a partnership with DPSST to come into their communities to establish a new facility. We received 12 community proposals across the state, and we also identified a state surplus site, which is a Department of Corrections site, which is in Salem, east of Salem, adjacent to CCI. During that process, we had formed, through our core facilities work group, actually prior to the release of that request for proposal, had established a set of siting criteria that will allow us to grade those proposals, as well as setting up some goals that we wanted that to meet, and those are listed in your proposal or in your package. We reviewed those proposals primarily based upon some initial criteria. That criteria primarily was to provide access in the Willamette Valley to our constituents and to our instructors. And as Diane's indicated, the predominant amount of those instructors are located in the valley. We have about 78% of the 350 that are located within the valley and draw upon those folks heavily, as well as about 80% of our constituent students come from west of the Cascades. In doing so, we identified seven sites that we had moved forward in that process. Those sites were Junction City, I'm going to make sure I remember all these, Junction City, Camp Adair, the Salem site, Monmouth came forward with the site, Escapoose came forward with the site, and then our Department of Corrections site, and Sweet Home as well. Thank you. I personally did site visits to all of those sites, and to establish the willingness of the community to look at the sites, to find out what the issues were. We looked at such things as wetlands, environmental issues, site configurations, floodplains, building structures on the current sites, anything that would kind of surface through that initial review. With the exception of the Escapoose site, I conducted all those survey site visits. The issue with Escapoose was that I had actually driven to the site in a time when I showed up. They announced that they had just reached an agreement, the Port of St. Helens had just reached an agreement with the owner of the property and were moving forward on another transaction. We took those sites, have gone back and given those sites to, actually created those sites against the criteria, came up with three finalists, and had given those sites to our engineer and architect to complete additional evaluations more specific to the cost of infrastructure, potential of those issues. Are there any hidden issues that we needed to start reviewing? We subsequently received a call from the representatives from Escapoose and requested that that site be reconsidered in the evaluation. We took a look at that site, scored that, and it came out in one of the top four sites and have been included in our continued evaluation of that process. Where we are today is we are continuing to do that process. We are having community meetings with those four communities. We've completed three of those community meetings. We are in the process, and we'll have on the 4th a community meeting with Salem neighborhoods, as well as the Neighborhood Association on the 10th. And we'll be talking to those folks about what we're looking at for the specific property involved at the Salem site. We're hoping to have all of that information retrieved and be able to analyze that on the 16th of April with our core facilities work group meeting, group, and be able to move forward a recommendation at that point in time to our steering committee as to a recommended site.
Final decision made by your steering committee? Is that the way it works?
We're hoping that we'll have one site that'll kind of jump out. At this point in time, each site is very, very different from one another. There are issues that we're still resolving on each one of the sites, but yes, we'll be moving forward through the steering committee.
The question is, who does make the final decision?
Chair Trow, I believe the final decision will be made not only by governor's approval of the site, but also this legislative body in terms of being satisfied and prepared to fund it.
Mr. Chair.
Sort of process. Go ahead.
But the state owns a Department of Corrections site? Salem?
Chair Trow, Representative Lambert, that is correct. The Department of Corrections owns that site.
And it would just seem like it, from an economic point of view, make more sense if we own that. Is that a factor?
Chair Trow, Senator, Representative Leonard, that is a factor that will be taken into account. However, in that particular site, we're working very closely with the City of Salem to determine what the infrastructure costs are going to be and determining what kind of capacities that we'd be able to have if we built there, whether or not we would have to put additional infrastructure in as well, which could be substantial if that's the case in that particular site.
Mr. Chair, and that isn't the case in the other three sites?
If you're looking at Chair Cho, Representative Leonard, in the case of the SCAPU site, there is a substantial cost for infrastructure. That site also is outside the UGB. They're in the process of trying to determine whether or not they can bring that into the urban growth boundary. The costs there are very substantial as far as getting infrastructure to that site. In the case of the Sweet Home site, there is infrastructure to the site, and it wouldn't require anywhere close to the type of infrastructure buildup. As far as the Monmouth site, the current site we're looking at there, they are in the process of building, the city's in the process of building a school adjacent to that property, and the city's committed to bringing the infrastructure out to that site. There will be additional infrastructure costs, specifically in the area of looping a water main through the subject property. But again, that is not sizable compared to some of the other sites.
Mr. Chair, but I'm mindful that somebody mentioned earlier that there are some that don't like to go to Monmouth because it's so far away. Are there any sites in terms of where they're located that are more attractive than others, just in terms of logistics?
Chair Trow, Representative Leonard, that is correct. We have completed a survey of our 350 part-time instructors, as well as we've gone to our staff and asked them the impact on them personally, specific to each one of these sites. What we've been able to determine is that both the Salem site as well as the Monmouth site would have considerably a much more minimum impact on those instructors and staff. Staff, we're looking at about a 2% impact as far as the instructors, it would be approximately the same. Where it would come on the negative side is that when we looked at Sweet Home and Scappoose, in the case of staff, it would have had a drastic increase where we were only looking at about a 20% increase, a 20% staffing that would actually make the move. In the case of the instructors, they were a little bit more mobile, and we were able to retain 30 to 40% of the people. Again, dependent upon which one of those two sites we're looking at.
If you chose the Monmouth site, would you use any of the existing academy at all in what's being done?
Chair Trow, at this point in time, we're not looking at using the existing campus at Western Oregon University. The issue, we looked at that specifically, as well as maybe even increasing the space on the campus, and in doing so, our engineers determined that there would be an increase in our infrastructure that would needed to increase the capacity for us to do that. The site is large enough at this point in time that we'd be able to incorporate all of the facilities on the proposed 180-acre site that they're moving forward. There may be an opportunity for a phase-in process that we could be looking at as far as phasing in the buildings in the development of the Monmouth site, because we have current facilities at Western Oregon.
It should be easier to phase in Monmouth, shouldn't it, if you're moving from one part of town to the other?
Chair Tro, that's correct.
Just on that point, prior to a funding decision being made, the E-Board has asked them to do a cost-effectiveness evaluation. Once they know a site, once they know what's going to be approximate to it, whether or not it's cost-effective to have some of the functions carried on at Western Oregon will be a part of that discussion.
Okay, so we're down to four sites, and do you think by the end of the legislative session there will be some sort of determination?
Chair Tro, it's our expectation that we will be very close by the end of this month, beginning of next month, to having that selection process complete so that we can come back for some more detailed discussions.
Further discussion of this, gentlemen? Proceed then.
Yeah. Just to set the context, the budget bill before you only has two components that will probably be addressed in work session. One is the debt service for the facility, and the second is the funding for the project coordinator, in this case Bob's position. It's part of the capital construction bill at this point, but regardless of whether they own the facility or DAS owns the facility, and there's a bill to discuss that and decide that, they do need to have the project coordinator position funded. So when we get to work session, if we do that this week, we would cover both the debt service and the project coordinator funding. The decisions surrounding the facility will wait until there's a site-specific proposal that can be brought back. And that may not happen for some time. What could happen in the capital construction bill is funding for them to get schematic drawings, site-specific work done, site acquisition, those kinds of things. So it's going to be done in stages. So. But before the decision before you will be whether or not to approve debt service and whether or not to approve funding for the project coordinator. Those are the pretty immediate decisions.
So the capital construction part of it be something this committee will do, or will there be a capital construction committee that will do it?
Chair Tro, committee members, I believe there will be a committee designated to deal with the capital construction bill, House Bill 5029, and that hasn't been done yet. It could be any one of the existing committees in Ways and Means, or another one could be formed.
Anything else?
I think that's about it, unless you have more questions.
What else do we want to do this morning, Mr. Russell?
Chair Tro, committee members, I don't have clearance from the chair to go into work session. We didn't schedule it for work session today, so tomorrow is a public hearing, possible work session. I'll work today to find out whether or not we can, and if that's the case, we will go to work session tomorrow. If not, I'll get notice to you that we won't need to meet tomorrow.
Will there be people that you will want to have here for a public hearing?
Senator Tro, there were a number of individuals that indicated they would like to come and make a public comment, but I think we've got it structured to just a few of them representing the disciplines, but I know there were a few that did want to say something
tomorrow,
if possible. They're scheduled for tomorrow, if that works for you.
Okay, great. Then we would have a public hearing tomorrow, for sure.
I guess we're adjourned then.
Thank you.
Thank you all.